Every community has a place where people meet and stories are told. The East Coast has stoops, the South has porches, and in Alaska, we have Arctic entries.
Here, Alaskans share their personal stories, funny, sad, and sweet. These stories are originally told at our monthly event in Anchorage. At each live performance, seven people tell a seven-minute-long, true story related to the show's theme.
I'm Jason Brandeis.
And I'm Rosie Robards.
Welcome to the Arctic Entries Radio Hour on KSKA Anchorage. Our theme for this show is Going Home. We have stories of traditions, reunions, and rivalries.
As usual, all these stories were originally told in front of a live theater audience as part of our live Arctic Entries events at the Alaska Center for the Performing Arts in Anchorage.
To kick off the show, we have a storyteller who isn't shy on stage at all. In fact, she's a professor at Alaska Pacific University who teaches public speaking. And really, ever since she was a child, she's had the personality for entertaining.
Here's Lynn Paulson, live at the Alaska Center for the Performing Arts.
I was so young when my parents told me that I was adopted that I don't remember a time in my life when I didn't know this fact about myself. They emphasized that it meant I was chosen, that I was wanted. They even reminded me that Moses was adopted. So being adopted was not exactly something I felt ashamed of. No, in fact, it made me feel pretty special. And I felt sorry for kids who arrived in their families in the usual way. I was born in 1959 in Berkeley, California. And I was adopted through a state agency, which at that time meant that your original birth certificate was shut, sealed, never to be opened again. But based on the questions that I asked growing up, my parents told me what they knew. So I knew, for instance, that my biological parents had been young graduate students at Berkeley, that they were engaged to be married when I came along, and that they were utterly unprepared for parenthood. I also came to understand that giving up a baby was a very painful decision for anybody to make. And so while I wasn't interested necessarily in searching for my biological parents, from a very young age, I wanted to reassure them. And so as a kid, I used to lie on my back on the grass and talk to them the way that other people talk to God. Whoever you are out there, it's cool. Don't worry. I grew up with an older brother who was also adopted, and his temperament was quite a bit like our parents, who were Scandinavians to the core. So he was reserved, quiet, calm, didn't like to make a fuss, didn't like to draw attention to himself. But you know that kid who's always bouncing off the walls and ceiling? The kid who never shuts up? The kid who turns every room they're in upside down? The kid with no off switch? I was that kid. I wasn't a bad kid, and I wasn't a mean kid, but I was always in trouble, especially in school, where I never shut up and I never sat still. And I was always bringing notes home to my parents for fighting, or I was spending time in the principal's office for doing things like standing on my desk and imitating our teacher as the Führer. If you were my babysitter, good luck. All right? Try to find me around bedtime, and chances were I had scaled the bookcase and was watching you from above on the beams that crossed the top of our living room ceiling. If you got me into bed, good luck keeping me there. If you got desperate and locked me in my room, which happened, I continued the show from under the door. My parents used to say that they hadn't adopted a daughter, they had adopted a howler monkey. And while I never felt self-conscious about being adopted, what I did feel self-conscious about was how different I was from the rest of my family. All right, everybody was sort of staid, and I was just bouncing all over the place. And I felt bad about that, but no matter how much I tried to shut it down and cage the monkey, I couldn't fly beneath the radar if my life depended on it. 5 minutes later, I'd be dancing on the coffee table. Flash forward to my 30th year. I'm a college professor by now, and by now I've reined in my more dubious tendencies. Mostly. I really kind of went underground, and I was kind of two different people. By day, college professor. By night, howler monkey. I had a swing set in my living room. I walked my dog at night wearing a cat costume. On weekends, I went to punk shows where I stage dove and crowd surfed. That fall of my 30th year, my parents wanted me to come home for a visit. And it wasn't a good time in the semester, but they were absolutely insistent, so I went home. And on the second morning of my visit, I learned the reason for it. They told me that my father had been headed out to go to the bookstore a few months earlier, and he'd asked my mother if there was any other books she wanted him to pick up. She said, yeah, as a matter of fact, there is. I can't remember the name of the title, but the word kindergarten is in it, and I can't remember the name of the author at all. But you should be able to find it. It's this wild bestseller. So my father came home in about an hour, and he pulled a book out of the bag, and he held it up, and it was Everything I Need to Know I Learned in Kindergarten by Robert Fulghum. And he said to my mother, "Does this name look familiar to you?" Of all the questions that I had asked them growing up, "Do you know the names of my biological parents?" was not among them. But if I had, the answer would have been yes. I learned that they were in possession of my original birth certificate. And yes, my mother did recognize the name. Robert Fulghum was listed as my father. I was kind of outside of my body by this point, far away and not quite getting my mind around what was happening. And my mother put the book down in front of me and said, "Have you heard about it?" And I said, "Yeah, of course I had. Everybody had." And she said, she put down a copy of the New York Times magazine that had a story about Robert Fulghum in it. And I turned right to that story and a two-page photo of the author sitting on a swing in his living room. Okay. I was so shocked seeing my face reflected back to me for the first time in my life, and a sense of primal recognition that came over me that I burst into tears. And my mother said, "Do you think this man's your father?" I said, "No question in my mind, yes." And so they said they would support me in whatever I decided to do with this information. And by that evening, I was in touch with both my biological mother and father and learned that, yes, they had gotten married. They'd stayed together long enough to have two sons and adopt a daughter, and that everybody lived in Seattle. My birth parents, my siblings, their children. And so in 2 days' time, I flew to Seattle, and I walked into utter mayhem. People bouncing off the walls and ceiling, people who had no off switch, people who were turning the room upside down, artists, poets, musicians, teachers, provocateurs who couldn't fly beneath the radar if their lives depended on it and didn't want to. Howler monkeys. At that moment, I had an opportunity that few people ever have to stare the nature versus nurture argument right in the face. And here is what it taught me. You are who you are. And I thought, what's so bad about being a howler monkey? Howler monkeys are awesome. It set me free.
You just heard Lynn Paulson on the Arctic Entries Radio Hour. Interesting side note, Lynn has her own business, and she appropriately named it Flying Heart Industries.
This is KSKA 91.1 FM Anchorage. On this hour, we hear Alaskans tell short, 7-minute stories about their lives. On this episode, we're hearing stories of going home.
And as usual, each storyteller has 7 minutes to share his or her story. You may have noticed the timer during that last story. At 5 minutes, the hosts of the Live Arctic Entries show let storytellers know it's almost time to wrap things up. And then, another timer sounds at 7 minutes to let storytellers know it's time to make way for the next speaker.
Next, we'll hear from Steve Cleary, who came to Anchorage by bike in 1998. Passionate about biking, he didn't buy his first car until age 33.
Steve is now one of the faces of Bike Anchorage, which is a group working to make Anchorage a more bike-friendly community. Here's a window into Steve's life and family.
It was the summer of 1971 in Bismarck, North Dakota, and my oldest brother, Pat, was driving my mom to the hospital to have me. And unfortunately, my father was out of town, and Pat only had his learner's permit, so he dropped my mom, he parked the car, and he walked home. And, yeah. As I was the 11th child in my family, my mom knew what to do by this time. And if you do some quick math, in 11 pregnancies, that's 440 weeks of being pregnant for my mom, or more than 8 straight years of her life. So yes, she did know what was coming and how it ended up. The fact that my father was an OBGYN at that same hospital added to the potential punchlines for this big Catholic family. But we all, and my mom knew the nuns there, so they would sneak her half a can of Budweiser in a coffee cup so she could relax, because as you might imagine, she was in no hurry to get home to that chaos. The 13 of us shared a pretty small house roughly the size that I share here in Anchorage with my wife Liz and my son Liam. And so my mom was always good at getting us out of the house and finding things for us all to do. We would swim a lot in the summertime. I remember her sewing patches on our swimsuits, which was your pass for family hour at the local pool all summer. And we'd pile into this big 12-passenger van that we had and zip off to the pool. My mom was always known as a fast driver, and we'd encourage her to drive fast over the bumps, because if you got the coveted back seat, you'd bounce up and hit your head on the ceiling. And we'd park and kind of storm the place, you know, run out, all of us going into this pool and swim our energy away. But I always remember two vivid pictures of my mom. She would, if she got in the pool, she would generally float on her back with her ears under the water, looking very serene because she couldn't hear very much. Or she would put a towel on the concrete and lie down, take her swimming suit straps off, and fall asleep. And she was really good at taking a nap anywhere and pretty much everywhere, and she definitely earned it. I contrast that with taking my 7-year-old son, Liam, to West High for swimming lessons, and all us parents are kind of hand-wringy in the bleachers, wondering why our sons and daughters can't swim better yet, or why they're not passing to the next swim level. And I think we all might do a little better if we had our ears under the water or took a nap. When my father was about my age, he quit smoking and took up running to get out of the house. And he ended up running 49 marathons in his lifetime. My mom's passion was for social change. So when I was 17, she ran for office and lost that campaign, but went on to win others and serve in the North Dakota House and Senate. She was a very diligent campaigner, knocked on every door in the district, and one woman had the temerity to ask her why she didn't stay home and raise her kids. And she politely said she'd done that for 32 years and was ready for something else. But even before she entered political life, the passion and energy and caring that she brought to her volunteer work and her community activism and her parenting really inspired me and rubbed off in a lot of ways that I am still realizing now. It's influenced a lot of my life as a person who chose to be a volunteer teacher for a while, to work for nonprofits, and to always have an eye on making the world and the community a better place. And I just hope that I've inherited at least a small percentage of the just great energy and passion and caring that she had. And it's great for me to see that now pass on to my son. Liam and I were working at a renewable energy fair booth this summer, and he heard me talking about bike safety, and after a few times through the spiel, he kind of took the booth over and was giving it better than I was. And it's a proud moment as a parent to see that and to see that come out in your offspring. And I know my mom had a lot of those in her lifetime. There's a picture of my son and my mom in the childhood home where I grew up, or my childhood home in the kitchen. One of the last times that I was home and that my mom was in that home. She's recently been diagnosed with dementia, and about a year and a half ago, we moved her out of that house where we all grew up for so long, and it's really been heartbreaking on many levels, many that I didn't realize. I didn't feel very nostalgic for the place, but to have that gathering space and that place where she could be the matriarch and gather us all in, I really feel that loss. And going home isn't the same now. It's we don't go back to that same place, and it feels really splintered. And coupling that with her losing her memory and not being able to remember the birthdays of her 31 grandchildren or her 2 great-grandchildren and all the things that she cared about and loved so much in her life, it's really heartbreaking, and it's tough to see that go, and it's really had a big effect on me and my family. And as I think about the future and what it'll be like 40 years from now when I'm my mother's age and my son is my age, and what will have transpired, what our relationship will be like, and what he will have learned from me, having me learn from my mom, and I've come to the realization that all the gifts and energy and passion and caring that that she's bestowed on me, those those gifts can't be repaid. They can only be passed on.
That was Steve Cleary, and you're listening to the Arctic Entries Radio Hour on KSKA Anchorage. I'm Rosie Robards.
And I'm Jason Brandeis.
Our next storyteller, Emily Tyrell, is originally from Emanuk, Alaska. But she didn't really get a chance to connect with her roots until later in life.
You might recognize Emily from her work with the First Alaskans Institute and as one of the founding members of the Forget-Me-Not movement, a group that reconnects Anchorage's homeless with their families.
So it was the summer of 2004. I had just moved to Alaska from Texas. And I was really excited about coming up here because my entire life, my mom would always tell me how Alaska was the most beautiful place on earth, how everyone who lived here was so nice, and it was my home. So when I arrived in Fairbanks, Alaska from Texas, I literally had a Bob Ross painting in my head. I thought there was going to be mountains everywhere, birds chirping, and happy little trees. But the truth is I was terrified of the ravens. I was extremely sad that there was hills instead of mountains, and it wasn't anything like I had pictured in my head. So when I got to my grandfather's house, I immediately called my dad, and I wanted to get on the next plane out of there. And it was during that conversation that my little sister Holly, who was 13 at the time, stopped me from talking, and she said, "Emily, you cannot leave me here." So I decided to stay. But under one condition, I was going to enroll in school, thinking that maybe this place might grow on me. So I enrolled in at UAF, and the truth is it was a rocky beginning, mainly because I was back at square one. See, growing up in Texas, the one question that everyone would ask me is, "Emily, what are you?" I mean, I have dark hair. I lived in a predominantly Spanish-speaking area. I love Selena. I was even part of a folklorico group. So here I am in Fairbanks, Alaska, being asked the same question, "Emily, what are you?" And I would tell them, "I'm Alaska Native." The first time my mom told me I was Alaska Native, I was 9 years old. And I remember this conversation because she was wearing beautiful purple and black beaded earrings. And although she couldn't answer the questions that I had about being Native, I remember instantly being drawn to these earrings. So when people would ask me in Fairbanks, Alaska, "Emily, what are you?" I would say, "I'm Alaska Native." And then they would say, "Well, what type of Native are you?" And I would look at them and I'm like, "A smart Native? A pretty Native? I don't know." And then they would ask me, "Well, who are your grandparents?" And I'm like, "Why do they want to know what my family, like, why are they asking me who my family is?" But I had no idea. So one night, everything really started changing. It was actually September 7th, 2004, and I remember this date because it was Jacob Tyrell's birthday. And I had gone to a birthday party, and once again, I was the only girl in heels in a room full of hoodies, and I was about to leave, and I heard a laugh. I heard a laugh that filled the room, and I looked over, and I saw a boy with the most beautiful blue eyes I'd ever seen in my life. I remember being drawn to him the way that I was drawn to my mom's earrings. And I told him a little lie. I told him I loved video games. And it worked. From that moment on, we were inseparable. We dated for about a year. And then we found out we were pregnant. We actually found out we were pregnant inside Fred Meyer, ironically. I had just picked him up on my lunch break. And I started feeling sick. And I told him, "Go to Starbucks, you know the coffee that I like," just to keep him busy. And I ran over the pregnancy aisle, I got the test, I checked out, I went to the bathroom, I found out I was pregnant, and I literally started bawling inside the bathroom at Fred Meyer. So I'm walking back into the store, and Jacob at the time, he said, "Emily, stop crying, I got you the wrong coffee." And I said, "I'm pregnant, you idiot." And he had the biggest smile on his face. In the time frame about 3 weeks, unfortunately, my mom's alcoholism got progressively worse. So in 3 weeks, we found out we were pregnant. We took my little sister, who was 15 at the time, away from my mom, and we moved into a bigger place. And by bigger, I mean two-bedroom apartment in Fairbanks. And Jake picked up a second job. It was the first time in my life that I had really experienced unconditional love like that. On December 14th, 2005, Jacob and I were married, and exactly 2 months later, we welcomed our beautiful little girl in this world on Valentine's Day, Anya Tyrell. Although we were kids raising kids, we had so much love within our household. Jake was the type of parent that would rush home from his lunch break just to hold Anya for 5 minutes. He was also the type of parent that would come with a list of questions ready to grill Holly's teachers. It was really a remarkable time in my life because for the first time, I really felt like I had a home. But all that changed on June 29th, 2007, when Jacob was killed in a motorcycle accident along the Steese Highway. Our daughter was 14 months old, my sister was 15, and I was 23. The day that we cremated Jake, I decided to read him a letter I had written, and in my letter I had told him how much I loved him and how much I appreciated his encouragement to find my native roots and how I loved that he loved my sister and our daughter unconditionally. And I remember putting the letter in between his cold hands, and I kissed his face and I said goodbye. But as hard as it was burying Jake, the hardest thing I've ever had to do is to console our daughter. When Anya was 3, you would think that she would wish for like a Disney vacation or some silly toy. But when I brought her her cake and I said, "Make a wish, baby," she said, "Mommy, I wish that you don't die." It took everything inside me not to hate God. And at the same time, it took everything inside of me not to take my own life. There were days when my sister and my daughter would literally have to pull me out of bed just to get up and go to work or to school. At the time, my dad saw that I was struggling, and he offered me a way out. He said, "Come back home to Texas." But I knew that Jake and I wanted a life for our girls, and I decided to stay. And thank God I decided to stay, because despite the loss of my husband, I'm not lost anymore. Because if someone were to ask me today who I was, I would tell them that I'm Emily Tyrell. I'm Yupik Ananupiak from Emonic, Alaska. I'm the granddaughter of John and Cecilia Sipri, and the great-granddaughter of Pearlie and Axel Johnson. I work for an incredible organization that's doing amazing things in the Native community. But what's most important and what it means to me is this. The way my mom's earrings were so special to me, this bracelet is special to me because it was the first time my daughter and I weaved together at the Elders and Youth Conference. Alaska has been able to give me a home, a sense of community, a sense of belonging. Guyana.
That was Emily Tyrell live at the Alaska Center for the Performing Arts in Anchorage. We found out that Emily's Yupik name means a person with a beautiful persona, spirit, and aura. Thanks for sharing your story, Emily.
You're listening to the Arctic Entries Radio Hour. Each month, the Arctic Entries Storyboard works with 7 Alaskans to share their stories. Anyone may volunteer to tell a story at one of our live shows. More on that at arcticentries.com.
Now we will hear from Lucy Barranco. She grew up in Chicago as the youngest of 7 in an Eastern Catholic family. Here she is.
The address on the envelope was for a small village called Rubaniacko in the far eastern side of Hungary near the Slovakian border. Arriving in Budapest with my flatmate Amina and my sister Marie, I didn't have the faintest clue where Rubaniacko was or even really how to pronounce it at the time. But as my father would always say, ye of little faith. So when we set out to find this little village in the far eastern part of Hungary, my heart was bounding with the faith with at the very least we'd be able to find this village and the house where my grandfather had lived. Now, I never knew my grandfather personally. However, he lived through the many stories my family would tell. One my Aunt Betty would always tell that I was always fond of was how he became a fugitive for stealing a loaf of bread. So my Aunt Betty was pretty pivotal in me finding this village because up until that point, all I knew was he was from, well, the old country. So when she sent me this nearly 40-year-old Xerox copy of a yellowing envelope and some squiggly cursive handwriting of an address for some weird village in Hungary, I knew it was the ticket to unlocking my heritage. We arrive in Rudabanyachko on a cool day in April. We arrived via Ferenc, who was the hostel innkeeper at the Greenbridge Hostel in Budapest. He had overheard my sister and I talking about finding this faraway village and knew he wanted to be a part of it. So he had offered to drive us the nearly 3.5 hours to the other side of the country. But little did Ferenc know that day, he wasn't only going to be our taxi driver, but he was about to become our translator. Because as soon as we arrived in Rudabanyachko, I knew we needed to find our family. So we arrived in Rudabanyachko, and it's this teeny tiny little village of about 300 people, near Shatra Juhe, which in Hungarian means the town at the base of the mountain that's shaped like a tent. So here we are in this cute little village behind the mountain that's shaped like a tent, going on what seems door to door, because that's really the best way to find your family in Eastern Hungary. You just knock on the door and say, "Hey, do you know Barenko?" So Barenko is my family name, and I've been told it means Barenko in Hungarian. And if you knew my family, Barenko, it's pretty applicable. So here we are going door to door, and it seems like this entire village is made up of these little babushka women, babushka meaning grandmother in Eastern Europe, and they fit every stereotype I remember as a child. The beautiful floral print headscarf tied under the chin, their beautiful smile, wrinkly face, hands worn from hard years of work, and they always had this little sparkle in their eye when they smiled, and it reminded me of my once surviving grandmother. And so we would go door to door and asking, "Do you know Barenko?" And Ferenc, our trusty translator, would be talking with these little babushka women, and 5, 10, 15 minutes would go by, and my sister and my flatmate and I are just like, "Wow, these little babushka women know a lot about Barenko." So we, "Ferenc, what are they talking about?" And he turns to us and he's like, "They don't know anything about Barenko. They're just super excited to have three American girls in this little village, and they're just, she's talking about her tomatoes and her chickens and like why her peas didn't come in last summer," and we're just like, "Oh." But inevitably, she would point us in another direction, and there we went on this wild goose chase looking for Barenko. Time and time again, we would get turned to this one house. A woman named Anna, they'd say, "She knows something about Barenko." We would go to Anna's house on the far side of the village, and her husband would come to the door. And he would always give us the same response. "Sorry, Anna's in town for a meeting, and she won't be home until late." It's at that moment we realize, whew, it is getting quite late. We should probably be heading back to Budapest as well. It is a 3-hour drive. Feeling a bit defeated, as we're walking down this beautiful dirt lane in this beautiful village, I see all these little babushka women from earlier in the day, except this time they have on beautiful overcoats and black boots, and they're holding a little black book. And I turn to Ferenc and I say, "Where are they going?" It's at that moment I hear the chime of the church bell, and I realize they're going to church, and it's Holy Thursday, and I'm in my grandfather's village in Hungary. You've got to be kidding me. It's a dream come true. So my sister and I, of course, beg Ferenc and Amina to allow us to go to church, and they accommodate and decide to go into town to have a coffee while we attend church, which we guaranteed them would only be an hour. So we assist these beautiful little babushkas down the dirt lane and up the long staircase to the base of the church. It's incredible. Modest church. The clock tower has a date on it. It reads 1888. The paint on the outside is this peeling yellow, just as much as the paint's peeling on the inside. You walk inside the doors, and it's this musty, damp scent. It's almost like walking into a tomb. It's dimly lit, mostly candles set around the icon screen and the iconostasis. It's everything I had imagined. Ruthenian Byzantine Catholic Church, just like the one I had grown up in. It was beautiful, and it really made me feel like I was at home. So, of course, if there's any Byzantine Catholics out there, you know that Holy Thursday liturgy is like 3.5 hours long. So my sister and I get out of church, and there's Ferenc and Amina very patiently waiting for us when the priests approach. And he invites us over to the house, because at this point, it's pretty late in the day, and we still have a long drive back to Budapest. And we're at the priest's home, and he's offering us tea and cookies and, you know, extending an apology for not being able to find our family. And it's just then that there's a knock on the door. And the priest answers the door, and there's a woman standing there in the doorway with a striking resemblance of my Aunt Betty. The same large, round, soft cheeks, blue eyes and beautiful Branko smile, standing there with her husband, the gentleman we had met earlier at the gate. It was Anna. She turned to the priest and she said, "Branko, we are Branko."
That was Lucy Branko, and this is the Arctic Entries Radio Hour on KSKA Anchorage.
This hour, we feature stories of traditions, reunions, and rivalries. Our theme is going home.
You might run into our next storyteller, Britta Hamry, when you're getting your delicious rustic goodies from Anchorage's Fire Island Bake Shop.
So I go fishing with my dad every summer, and it's a tradition that is familiar to many of you here tonight, but it's something that didn't really start until we were at our most distant, a point in my life where I didn't know if I was going to continue to have a relationship with my father. It was January of 2011. It was dark, cold, and snowy, as it ought to be in winter in Anchorage. And it was getting later and later, and my dad had yet to come home. He wasn't answering his phone. None of his colleagues knew where he was. And as it got darker, we got more worried, and my mom decided she was going to go to Providence Hospital, where he was practicing as a pediatric oncologist, to look for him. And though my twin sister and I were 17, juniors at Service High School, and we had just gotten separate bedrooms, that night I went down to our formerly shared bedroom, and we crawled into the same bed and held each other and waited. And it felt like a really long time. It felt like forever, and we finally got a call from our mom. And she had found our dad, and he was in a rough condition, but he was alive, and he was going to spend the night in the hospital. So the next day, we went to school, and we were running on what little sleep we had had the night before, and during third period was the junior prom assembly. So they pulled the whole class out of our actual academic work, it was totally worth it, into the gym so they could announce prom royalty. And my sister and I were both on prom court, which is perfect. We're twins, there was no sibling rivalry. And everyone who was on prom court, their parents were there taking pictures, and our mom was there, but not our dad, because he wasn't allowed to leave the hospital, if even for an hour. And so the week went on, and there were tests to take and papers due, and we were visiting our dad in the hospital trying to cheer him up, and I still had to come up with excuses for why I wasn't doing my pre-calc homework. And the Friday before junior prom, as fate would have it, I had an orthodontist appointment, and I got my braces removed, which if this was a teen movie would be perfect, because previous to this point in my adolescence, I really tried hard not to show my teeth when I smiled, so I either kept my lips closed or it was this really awkward grin where I was trying to pull my lips down in front of my teeth because I hated my braces. I had them for forever, and so the next day comes, and prom is at the PAC, so this is not my first time on stage at the PAC. Not the most traditional prom locale, but they weren't allowed to have it at the Anchorage Museum again after the previous year. So so we get on stage, I'm pretty sure it was the Atwood, I can't remember which theater, you know, and all the lights are on the whole time. We're told we can only dance face-to-face, and there's plenty of chaperones intermingling. And you guys know what happens. And so they announce prom queen, and it's me. And I just told this story because I wanted people to remember that I was prom queen. It's like, it's been a while trying to ride that wave. And so it's me, and my mom was there to take pictures, but our dad was still in the hospital, so he couldn't be there. So the next morning, Sunday morning, for visiting hours, we go and we visit our dad, and we're sharing with him our prom night and the pictures and how beautiful our dresses were, and we have our sashes on, and I have my crown on, and we're talking about how our makeup was, and my hair never stays in curls, but it was curly at the beginning of the night, and I'm sitting on the vent underneath the window, and my dad shares with us why he has been in the hospital. He had attempted suicide. And if you want someone to feel stupid while you tell them serious news, make sure they're wearing a plastic crown, because it was highly effective. And I remember sitting on that vent, just wanting to run and just wanting to unhear what I had just heard, but I made myself sit there. And instead I thought about how overwhelmed I was and how great it would be to just slip through that vent and not be there. And though my family was staggering underneath the weight of this trauma, life still went on in this surreal way, and there were ski meets to go to and tests to take and ACTs and SATs, and I still had to come up with excuses for why I wasn't doing my pre-calc homework, and summer jobs were had and high school romances, and my sister and I were captains of our running team. And all of this was happening, but I wasn't really sharing it with my dad. I wasn't really talking with my dad. I was so hurt, and I was so angry, and it was just so convenient to be angry that I didn't even try to start to understand what he was going through. And so two summers later, after holidays and birthdays and other milestones have come and gone without much other than an awkward exchange, I find myself in a car with my dad driving down to the Kenai to go fishing, because life still goes on and that's what you do in Alaska, except my dad and I had never gone fishing together before. And I don't remember who initiated this outing, but we didn't really talk much on the drive down. I fell asleep, but my dad was driving, so it was all good. And we get there, and it's one of those gray, murky days where the sky and the water just kind of meld together at the horizon. And I'm having a little bit better luck than my dad, and so I'm headed back into the water with my dip net. And this big, burly man stops me, and he says, "Is that man your father?" And it was one of those weird small-town Alaska moments that I hadn't really experienced yet. My family moved here from Michigan in 2008, and I say, "Yeah, that's my dad." And he points upriver to this cute little blonde girl and her brother playing in the mud, and he says, "Your father not only saved my daughter's life, he saved my family." And I'm sitting underneath the window on that vent again. I want to run, I want to bolt, I want to unhear what I just heard, but I'm knee-deep in the mud, and I just wish that the water would take me away with it. Because I knew my dad was a great and compassionate doctor, but what about my family? Who is going to save us? And healing is hard. It's hard work that my family does every day. But sometimes the great thing about tradition is you don't have to think about it. You just do it. And this summer, I went fishing with my dad, and we filled my freezer with salmon. Thank you.
That was Britta Hamry live at the Alaska Center for the Performing Arts.
Our next storyteller on this hour of Arctic Entries Radio is adventurer David Kachadorian. David spends his time between Alaska and Hawaii.
So it was the summer of 1991, and I was turning 20 years old, and I decided I was going to bicycle across the United States. So I did the most logical thing and called Alaska Airlines and asked for a ticket to Nome. The kind lady said, "There's no roads connecting Nome with the rest of the country." So I got a ticket to Fairbanks starting on August 10th. It was a little late in the season, but I figured I could spend 5 days getting to the border and make it. On the plane ride up here, a couple of folks from Anchorage suggested I go see Denali, so 5 days turned into 10. On the ride out of Fairbanks to Nenana, all I saw were trees and trees and trees, and I decided there really wasn't anything in Alaska for me. Until a few days later, and I met a woman outside of Palmer. She had a cabin. She invited me over for tea. Tea turned into dinner, into breakfast. And then 3 weeks later, she said, "Why don't you spend the winter?" Well, I was really looking forward to doing a long bicycle tour, and I'd only been riding for a week when I met this woman with the cabin. So I said, "I'm not staying in this godforsaken place." There was snow on Pioneer Peak already, and it was September 10th. So I got on my bicycle, and I headed for Tok and rode through the Canadian border, and it was getting cold. And to save a few days, I decided to take the Cassiar Highway through British Columbia. For those of you who don't know, it's 360 miles of unpaved road, or it was at that time, and it's about 100 miles between towns. So one afternoon, this yellow pickup truck with Alaska plates pulls over to the side of the road, and this shady-looking character gets out. "Kid, I've been driving this road for 20 years. I have never seen anybody on a bicycle on this road." "Are you crazy? How about I give you a ride into the next town and buy you a cup of coffee?" "Well, I wanted to be able to say I rode all the way from Fairbanks to Florida on a bicycle, so I wasn't going to take any rides." He says, "Well, kid, let me take your picture because my wife's not going to believe this." I said, "I have to charge you for that." And I was just joking. And the guy gave me $5. So as he gets back in his truck, he hands me a silver business card and says, "If you ever want that cup of coffee, let me know." And he drove off into the distance. So over the next month, I bicycled into Prince George, Vancouver, into Seattle, over Mount Rainier National Park. And that's when the tent started to get ice on it in the morning. And winter was getting very close. And I rode down into Yakima and into eastern Oregon. And one Sunday morning, it was so cold at 6:30 that I had to get out and get on my bicycle because I could not stay in the tent anymore. It was that cold. And I was not bought any food the night before. And I was just looking for a place to get something warm to drink and get some food. And there was snow on the foothills that morning, and nothing was open. And I was thinking, I should have stayed with that woman back in Alaska. And just then, a yellow pickup truck pulled over with Alaska plates. "I thought that was you, kid. You ready for that cup of coffee yet?" And I was. His name was Lonnie, and I won't tell you his last name. And he put my bike in the back of his truck. He drove me into Pendleton, Oregon, and bought me breakfast. And at breakfast, he told me he had laryngitis, and he couldn't really talk to his customers, but he had some work to do before heading back to Alaska. And if I was willing to help him, he would take me back to Alaska with him. So I called the woman in the cabin and said, "Is that offer to spend the winter still open?" And it was. So over the next 2 weeks, Lonnie and I sealed driveways, but we only did 3 jobs. And Lonnie, being a very kind-hearted person, was spending way more money putting us in separate motel rooms and feeding me than we were making doing work. So finally, after 2 weeks, Lonnie gave up and we headed back to Alaska. Now, the whole time, Lonnie was getting calls on his car phone. Now, this was 1991, almost nobody had a car phone. And he was getting calls from bill collectors. And he was telling these people that he had put the money in the mail. And I'd been with him all day. He hadn't put any money in the mail. Now, I had money, and I felt kind of bad because Lonnie hadn't asked me for any money. He had invested in me, and that investment wasn't really paying off. So we got to the border, and the folks at the border told us that he had a warrant for his arrest, and we had 2 hours to get to Tok. I was getting a little nervous at this point. So we got to Tok, and the troopers told us, "Oh, it was just a big mistake. Sorry, that was a ticket that was paid years ago," and I was a little relieved. And true to his word, Lonnie got me back to Fairbanks, where I spent most of the money I had left to get back to Anchorage to see the woman in the cabin. That night, we got the largest snowstorm I'd ever seen. And the next morning, I grabbed a snow shovel, and I went door to door, using a little bit of something I learned from Lonnie, and I started making more money than I ever had, and I started my first business in Alaska. And growing up in Southern California, I'd never felt at home, but in Alaska, I felt at home. And that winter, I made Alaska my home, and so I wanted to repay Lonnie for what he'd done, and so I called the phone number on the business card, and it was disconnected. And I sent a letter to the address on the business card, and it came back as no such address. Well, I'd always wanted to repay Lonnie, but I'd kind of given up on ever seeing him again. And then about 4 years later, I was in line at a convenience store, and I heard that unmistakable voice behind me, and I turned around, and I went up to him. He says, "Is that you, kid?" And it was. I says, "I've been trying to get a hold of you." He says, "Oh, well, just call me." And he hands me a silver business card. And I had very little money on me at the time, or I would have given him a bunch. And I went home that night and called the number, and it was disconnected. And I went back and looked at the business card I had in my journal, and it was the same business card. So I didn't even try the address again. So I almost saw Lonnie by 24 hours, a couple of years later. He came into a store I was working at and bought a couple of trucks. And I saw his last name on the log when I came in and tried to get his contact information. Well, the contact information he'd given them was no good either. In 2002, I was driving through Spinard, and I saw that little yellow pickup truck in front of the Paradise Inn. And I ran into the front counter. I said, "What room's Lonnie in?" And she told me, and I confirmed it was him. I ran to the bank. I withdrew a wad of cash, and I came back, and I knocked on his door, and, "Is that you, kid?" It was. And he had had a really bad day. His wife had been medevaced. Now, Lonnie was old. I don't know how he was still having children, but his wife was medevaced down from Fairbanks the night before, having complications with one of his children's pregnancy. So anyway, I took that wad of cash out and gave it to Lonnie and thanked him and hugged him for helping me find a home in Alaska, and I haven't seen him since.
That was David Kachadorian, and this is the Arctic Entries Radio Hour.
Our last storyteller for this show is aspiring to the core competencies of adulthood. His mom tells him he's getting close. He lives in Anchorage, works at the boardroom, and subsists off cans of Amy's lentil soup.
Here's John Henry Heckendorn.
My parents met smuggling Bibles into the Soviet Union. Suffice to say, I grew up pretty religious, saying grace before dinner and prayers before bedtime, and obviously going to church every Sunday. Until, like a lot of people, I went to college, and when my parents weren't looking, I became more agnostic. 2 years ago, I got the chance to spend 4 months working in Washington, D.C. And on the plane flight over from Anchorage, I had a little too much coffee and got kind of carried away. And I decided to make this list of all the things I was going to do with my time in the big city. So I was going to play on an adult recreational sports team. I was going to take salsa dancing classes, which didn't work out very well. And I was going to make my mom happy by attending church regularly. So I was in D.C. a week. I woke up on Sunday morning, and the thing about Sunday mornings is they come after Saturday nights, right? So I was a little bit hungover. I really didn't feel like going to church, but it would have been kind of lame to fail on the first attempt. I hadn't done any homework on churches in the area, but I figured I'd just get on my bike, start biking down the street, and I go to the first church I saw. Piece of cake. And so, fortunately, the first church I saw was just 2 blocks away from my house. But unfortunately, it was like an older church, and it was kind of hard to get into. And then you had to take this elevator up to the second floor where they had the service, and the elevator was really old and rickety. But finally, I got up to the second floor, and I walk in, and that's when I realized that this isn't just a church that is full of black people. This is a definitively black church in that there are women in fancy hats with the fans, and there's a full-on gospel choir at the front singing away. And importantly, I'm the only white person in the building, and it's not like what I'm used to going to church. But it took me a while to get in there, so I figured I better just go for it. So I sit in a pew in the back, towards the middle. The church wasn't really full when I got there about 10 minutes after the service was supposed to start. But people keep trickling in and trickling in until the place is absolutely packed, except for my pew, which just has me in it. The pew just in front of me, the middle part of it didn't have anybody in it, and the pew behind me, no one in it. So I'm sitting there in my little bubble of whiteness, feeling pretty silly. And it doesn't help that no one seems happy to see me. I can tell I'm getting a lot of strange looks, and even the little kids who are like crawling over their mom's shoulders to peer at me from over the backs of the pews in front don't look pleased. But everyone is singing and clapping and dancing along with the gospel choir, and this puts me in a bit of a quandary. I can tell that it's going to be weird if I don't sing, but I'm not feeling particularly groovy because, like, those salsa dance classes haven't really kicked in yet because I've only been there a week, right? So I sort of start, like, singing in this, like, quiet voice and doing this, like, clappy, shuffly thing, and it's like, hallelujah, and it's not very good, and I can tell I can tell I look like an idiot, but I don't know how to stop looking like an idiot. Sorry, I lost my train of thought. But then the sermon, I tell myself that I just got to grit my teeth and get through it. It'll be over soon. So an hour later, the sermon starts. And it becomes clear this pastor hasn't like written out a little speech to give like for 20 minutes beforehand. He's going to talk about whatever he needs to talk about, and he's going to take as much time as he wants to do it. And while this is happening, a woman starts shuffling into my pew, and this is the first time anyone's come into my pew besides me. So I'm interested to hear what she has to say. And she whispers in my ear that the pastor has noticed me, and he'd like to pray for me after the sermon in front of everybody. Probably because I look like I needed some help. And I tell her in no uncertain terms that that's very nice of her, but the sermon is doing me just fine, and I won't be needing any prayers. And she says, she doesn't seem very happy about that, but she's going to tell the pastor, and she'll see what he says. But she warns me that he might just do it anyway, so that's comforting. So I'm waiting, and then the sermon ends, and the prayer starts, and I'm kind of sweating, like hungover sweat. And I notice this guy walks in, this like athletic-looking, tall, young guy with like this cool blonde streak in his hair. And I learned that this guy's name is Tyrell. He's the quarterback of the high school football team locally. He hasn't been to church in 2 or 3 weeks, and he got into some sort of recent unspecified trouble in school. And the reason I learned all of this is because the pastor also notices Tyrell come into the building, and he immediately changes his prayer. So he's still like praying to Jesus, but he's praying about Tyrell, and he's saying that, you know, Tyrell could be in the NFL someday, but he's never going to make it if he doesn't start like cutting up and doesn't come to church more often. And the whole congregation is showing no mercy to Tyrell. They're saying hallelujah and like praise Jesus and making like affirming noises to the pastor, and Tyrell is literally like squirming in the back corner, and I'm sort of looking at him. And this goes on for like 10 minutes, and I'm sitting there like, if this is how they treat one of their own members, what the heck are they going to do when it comes time to pray for me? But then the prayer ends, and it turns out that Tyrell has saved me because he distracted them. They forgot about me. So they have the closing hymn and the offertory, and I think I'm in the clear, right? I think I'm going to get out of there without being publicly humiliated, and I can just never come back. But then the pastor gets up to say one last final word, and he says, now they've come to the part of the sermon where they like to recognize their guests. And everyone's head just like turns to look at me. And he says, I've been looking around the church today, and I see a lot of, you know, unfamiliar faces, or familiar faces, but there's one. And I think in my head, a very, like, unchurch-like. And he kind of peers at me from the pulpit, and he says, son, why don't you come on up here and tell us who you are and where you're from and what you're doing here? And there's more of those, like, affirming noises as he says that. People are like, yeah, what is this guy doing here? And so I kind of just like stagger up to the front, and I'm feeling really shaky, and I sort of put my face to the microphone, and I just say, hi, my name's John, I'm from Alaska, and I just wanted to come to church this morning. That was all I could think to say, and that somehow broke the ice. The audience erupted. It turned out later that they thought I was a journalist. They'd had a bad experience with a journalist who'd come to church before who was also white. But when they found out it was just this schmuck from Alaska who didn't know where he was going and wanted to come to church, they were all about it. And people were saying hallelujah and praise Jesus. And this one guy was like, Alaska, that's cold. And this other guy was like, I just wanted to come to church today too. You know, and people are coming up. The service is over now, so they're hugging me and giving me handshakes. And the pastor recruits me to play on his inner church league basketball team. And this lady tells me she's going to pray for my mom because my mom must be missing me back in Alaska. She doesn't even live in Alaska, but I didn't tell them that. And they kept saying, John, we'll see you next week. And they did, because after that, how was I not going to go back? So I went back every week for 4 months, and I played in the basketball games, and I went to the potlucks, and that's how I started going to church again.
That was John Henry Heckendorn at the Alaska Center for the Performing Arts, and this has been the Arctic Entries Radio Hour.
Thanks for tuning in. To hear these stories again or to share them with friends, visit arcticentries.com or alaskapublic.org.
Our website also has information about upcoming themes, live shows, and details on how you, too, could tell a story.
We'd like to thank our storyboard and the storytellers for this show. All of the proceeds from our shows are donated to a local social services nonprofit. Information about this is also at arcticentries.com.
Thanks to our audio engineer from the Alaska Teen Media Institute, Kendall Stormo, and thanks to Anchorage's own Super Saturated Sugar Strings for our theme music.
This has been the Arctic Entries Radio Hour on KSKA Anchorage. I'm Jason Brandeis.
And I'm Rosie Robards. Thanks for listening, and we look forward to hearing your stories.
New things to come. And I love your lips. Wanna give me some? We fuss and fight when things go wrong. Will we laugh and sing every day a new song?
We'll just have to see what we'll be, will be. We can swim or sink in our new beginning. Oh, I'll just let it be. No more inquiries. Darling, I'll need no more reassuring. Things are looking up, you're the best of them all. Will I keep my word? Would I have resolved? Eat a little less pork and be nice to you all. Don't need to know what the future stores. Just need your touch, who could ask for more? Of this year, will my face look the same? Will we fall in love or just fall like the rain?
We'll just have to see what will be, will be. We can swim on the sea in our new beginning.